Okay, this is Elena Zulli interviewing Fumio Ichikawa on June 4th, 2007 in Barney Building of NYU. Okay, Fumio, start by going over your background. Tell me about where you were born, when, etc.
Okay, I was born in 1968 in a small town in Kanagawa, which is a prefecture next to Tokyo. My parents were both from that region. And they lived in Tokyo at the time, but traditionally women goes home to their parents to give birth. So I was staying with my grandparents when I was born. It's an interesting story. Like, my great-grandfather passed away 2 weeks before I was born. It was a naturalist. He went to sleep. He had a habit of taking a nap in the afternoon by the sunny spot on by the window. And one day he didn't come back after the sunset, so my father was visiting my mother, and it's in my maternal grandparents' home. And my father went to wake up my great-grandfather, and he never woke up. So my father was actually the first one who discovered my great-grandfather passing, and it was almost like exactly 2 weeks before I was born. And depending on what you believe in, but in some of the Buddhist mythologies and the ideas about the incarnation and the idea of like passing from this life to the next life and in between, that's just about the time where you were supposed to be crossing over this liver that separates this world to the next one, wherever that may be. And there may be, he may never have left, he may have stayed with me, and sort of decided to take residence in my mother's womb. And the reason why I mention that is my great-grandfather actually wanted to come here to the United States. He was a fifth son of a very large family, and because of the primogeniture, it's like oldest son takes over the family and the family business and the land. So he wanted to, strike a fortune outside, so he actually got on the ship heading over to the United States. I think he made it over to Hawaii. Then that's when he found out that his older brother passed away and he had to go back, so he never made it to the mainland. But his plan was to come to the United States, make a lot of money, go home successful, which quite didn't happen, but he did make it to the to Hawaii. So my family came here when I was 17 because of my father's job. Everybody left but me. After my father's assignment ended, they went back. I stayed behind. And I have a feeling, I never thought of it that way earlier, but now that I think about it, I think it's my great-grandfather making me stay. So that's one of the family or the personal sort of legend that I have about me being here. So I grew up in suburb of Tokyo. It's within Tokyo Prefecture, but it's one of the new development in the 70s. There was a lot of urban growth, but not affordable housing in central Tokyo. So there was a planned housing project all over suburbs in the countryside where there was nobody. So I grew up among people from all over Japan. Their parents came on job assignment, they came for higher education and stayed, or they're transient, moving from different city to city. But so it was an interesting environment. Nobody was from there. Everybody sort of came there, everybody lived there, but so many different dialects, so many different cultures. During the summer vacation, the town emptied out, because everybody went back home to their grandparents, where their parents are from. So it was a very interesting time that everybody knew each other and their parents and nothing beyond. You came there without like no baggage, no family history, just you. So there was no sense of like insiders, outsiders, and also the kind of what we call village mentalities that a lot of people associate with the Japanese, where you're closed in.
Village mentalities?
Yeah, basically. Everybody knows everybody's parents, cousins, who married whom. We didn't have that growing up. We didn't have natives versus outsiders. Our class size grew from like 15 starting on the beginning of the year. By the time we moved into the next grade, we had 30. So that was the norm, which is very unusual in most of Japan.
The growth, you mean?
Well, just in terms of the growth as well as sort of the mobility of people. is quite unusual. So when I compare my experience to my cousins who grew up closer to my grandparents, it's a very, very different thing, where they grew up with all kinds of history. Like, even before they go to school, everybody knows you. Because both my grandparents were teachers. So all the teachers from your school, the next school over, the parents, they knew who you are before coming in. Whereas where I, me and my sister grew up, it's like, it's just you. And, you know, you get to know other people's parents through the kids. So the connection with the children, not necessarily the kind of kinship or the location or sort of family history that you brought. So that was unique, I think. So that gave me a different perspective from a lot of people who grew up sort of tied to the land and the community and family history. So that was really interesting and fun place to grow up. And then my father was transferred here when I was 16. We didn't come here until the year later because my sister really wanted to graduate from junior high school before coming here. I was happy to leave Japan. My mother and my sister weren't. They were so afraid of going to places where they don't speak the language, they don't have any friends, all kinds of anxieties. I was ready to leave. I was not happy where I was because of many different things, but and also I had a very different image of the United States, being like more individualistic, freedom, creativity, democracy, blah, 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 compared to sort of Japan in the 80s where things were very structured. Well, it seemed very structured.
Even in your area?
Yeah, well, it was because of the national sort of, it was a time of the economic growth and there was an expectation that the parents wanted their children to do better, and there was a very specific and clear path to do better. Higher education was the key, and there were school ranks, and it was very clear that which colleges or university you went to connected you to the types of opportunities you had after graduation. It's a lot more systematic than here. I mean, really, here it's more sort of implicit in sort of class and networking aspect of it.
Right.
In Japan, once you get to a particular school, the network is there for you. It doesn't matter where you come from, you get plugged in. So everybody understood that, and everybody sort of aspired to that. And also there was a shift from highly urbanized economy and society around that time, like a market economy, and global economy impacting a lot in terms of how Japan was shaping up to be very much urban-centered society. Transition from like the pre-war, more small towns, villages, and diversity of that to everybody aspiring to be the city dweller with the latest and the greatest. So I think it was a time of convergence of many different influences, defining very clear, singular idea of what's successful. And I was ready to get out of that. part of the reason is you go through entrance examination after you graduate from junior high. I mean, some wealthier kids go through that earlier, but for most, you know, kids, that's sort of the first rite of passage around age 15. After you graduate from junior high, you choose a high school to go to. You decide if you can go to public schools, private schools, you stay close to home, or you travel. There aren't really that many boarding schools, so it's really like you take the train to commute like an hour and a half versus staying at the school that's close to home, maybe like within half an hour radius or not. But that's sort of the first time you get filtered into different groups based on academic performance, but there's a lot more to it than that. And when I got to high school, it was a very different world because we mixed with, that was my first encounter with people outside of my community, which were very, very diverse. It was weird, like I go to a new community, it's a lot more homogeneous than the diversity that I was so used to in terms of people's expectations. The weird thing about where I grew up is that it's economically very homogeneous. Because of the housing project, housing prices, rental versus, I guess it would be equivalent of co-ops here, determines, you know, your parents' income level, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, where you live and the community we lived in was based on the fact that everybody could afford to live in the same right. housing project.
And it was it middle class?
Well, it's really like the middle class back then in Japan versus what we would think of middle class here versus what we would think of middle class in Japan, not a completely different thing. It was okay. before the economic bubble of the early 90s. So it's a working community, mostly like mix of white collar office workers, some professionals, teachers, you know, a lot of the school teachers, office workers, but not like senior management.
Okay.
It's sort of, you know, middle to lower management. And also generationally, they were still young. So mm-hmm. you know, they were on the path to becoming middle managers and senior managers, but not quite there yet.
Right.
So culturally, we were very diverse, but economically, we were very homogeneous. And then when I went to high school, we get thrown into the places where economically, it's very, very diverse. That was like the first time I actually met somebody whose parents owned like sushi restaurant, you know, like the small business owners, mm-hmm. The shop owners. I wasn't used to that. I'm used to dealing with, you know, teachers, office workers, people who commute to work, mm-hmm. versus you have your business at home and you sort of grew up in that environment. That was very different. But at the same time, it was very, I mean, I think it's the same high school ever. It's very cliquey.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite fit into both the cliques and also sort of the culture of the time. That was very, it's going to be like a really long history of like Japanese culture, say from the 60s to the 80s, but it was a time of a very conservative period. A lot of the people who were student radicals in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, sold out, became an office worker, and they're sort of, you know, telling their children that you have to study really hard, you know, go to the good school, get a good job, work for major corporations, and your life will be successful and stable. And I knew those are the same people who burned down the campus and didn't have a graduation because they were against what was going on in Vietnam, what was going on with the treaty between the United States and Japan, the security treaty. They were against the nuclear war blah, 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 mm-hmm. in the 60s, and it's the same people
right.
telling us, no, you know, this is the way to happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really frustrated with the fact that I have to sort of stay within that scheme of things. And I wasn't creative enough, I wasn't talented enough to just say, forget you, I'm going to do my own thing. So I was reasonably smart enough to do well enough in academic performances. That was like what I was good at, but I didn't really like the fact that was the only thing you got measured at.
Mm-hmm.
And what you get at the end. And also the fact that there was a vague understanding and expectation that even if I do as well as the boys, you know, I can score as high on the exams, but there will be other attributes. I'm doing a quotation mark here. Attributes that teachers would add to the application process that would not necessarily like disadvantage me in terms of going to college itself, but at the end of the process that that sort of is not, it's going to matter less than the fact that I'm a girl,
mm-hmm.
Which unbeknownst to me drastically changes in the 4 to 7 years that I'm going to be away, but that was the understanding then before I left.
So you're saying that it was harder for girls to get into college?
No, college examination process was fairly straightforward. You take the exam, you pass, you get in.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't any slot based on gender. But to get to high school, especially public high schools, there was a little bit of a backlash on heavy reliance on testing, academic testing. So a few years before I, well, maybe when I was in junior high school, the government decided, the Tokyo government decided to add a few extra weight to like art, music, home economics, and what's the last one? Physical education. Mm-hmm. We had 9 subjects. Those four are sort of more based on, you know, non-academic talent, and we had like 5 different subjects: Japanese, English, math, science, and social science. Before you take the exam in 5 subjects, if you score high, you get in. After the reform, you have to carry the score, your grades from your school, but your 4th subject is going to be weighed a lot heavier than your academic subject. So before you go take the exam, your sort of range of schools that you can apply is predetermined by how well you do in your school, mm-hmm. including those 4 non-academic subject, which is very subjective in terms of, yes. you know, getting the A in those categories versus taking the exam and scoring 100 on the academic side of it. So, and it was fairly common that, you know, if you had the same score and if you were sort of borderline between the A-line schools versus the B-line schools, that the teachers gave a little bit of an edge to the boys. Mm-hmm. And also the expectation is that a lot of the women would go to junior college as opposed to the 4-year college, work a few years, and get married. Mm-hmm. So the aspiration, it's not necessarily that it was structural barriers to getting to 4-year college, but the aspirational pattern were very different for boys mm-hmm. and girls. It wasn't the case with my family. The expectation with my family is always like, you know, you go to 4-year school. And I think, looking back, my father never said that I couldn't do something because I was a girl. And I think I owe that to my paternal grandmother. But it was a shock to me when I was talking to my classmates in high school that your parents actually tells you that, you know, these are ungirly, girl-like things, or things that women are not supposed to think about or wish for. I mean, it's a very stereotypical view of the Japanese society, but it was true to some extent, especially with the small business owners more than the mm-hmm. other professional families. But even then, most of the mothers are stay-at-home or work part-time, but there aren't that many professions that women could stay after they get to a certain age or they get married and have family. So it was mostly teachers, nurses. Very few office workers who are white professionals. So that was sort of the environment I was in, and I was also not happy with the way everything is weighed the same. You know, you could be really good at one subject, you could really suck at another subject, and that would bring your whole average down instead of, you know, you sort of developing what you're good at. Mm-hmm. And sort of keeping up with what you're not so good at passing, and still be able to go to a place where what you're good at and your intellectual curiosity and desire get fulfilled. Like mm-hmm. everything has to be sort of averaged downwards to where you're not good at. And I had this whole image of the United States being different, that you can actually develop your own personal sort of strength. Mm-hmm. So, and also like sort of gave me a way out of being ordinary. You know, I'm going to New York.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, whoa, you're going to New York. So it just, you know, automatically, I didn't have to do anything. Just by the virtue of my father being transferred, I'm somebody special, which was a nice feeling as an average kid. So that brings us to 1986, spring of 1986. So we waited until my sister graduated from junior high school, got here in April. Not a good idea because academic year is about to end and nobody wanted to put us into school because they were about to, it was about the time that in New York State, I don't know how familiar you are with the New York State education system, but they have a Regents exam, mm-hmm. And all the teachers are concerned about getting everybody passing the Regents at that time.
Right.
And because we didn't speak English all that well, and because some of the bilingual students don't want their star student, they didn't want their student, you know, star student being distracted by babysitting us, right. Basically. So I started school in Long Island in the ESL classes, most of the subject except math, because math you don't need language. And the math teacher in that class really hated having me because she thought I was going to drag her star student down. Mm-hmm. After we take the lessons, for me it was like high school entrance exam. I thought it was a joke. I didn't think it was for 11th graders.
Right.
So once they saw the score, just, you know, complete turnaround in the way teachers looked at me. And math was my worst subject.
Your worst subject?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So it was an interesting experience. But for a few years after that, because of my limitation in understanding spoken English, everybody treated me like I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. That was the vocabulary and the range of expression that I had. So it's not easy being a teenager in Long Island around that time. But on top of that, there was that struggle of having a 17-year-old brain stuck behind the vocabulary of 5 years old.
Yes.
So my high school days were pretty much confined to hanging out with other kids from ESL. Other kids in ESL classes from all over the world, which was great in one way. But at the same time, there was definitely a divide between what we would call regular class students and the ESL student. And gradually you move over as your English gets a little better, and also you start to take classes. And for us, most of the Japanese kids, we are really well trained to read and write. And you know, we take homework seriously, we try to keep up. So in terms of trying to get up to speed and being able to participate in regular classes, wasn't that big a deal. Like, we just need a little bit of time to get used to it.
Right.
And spend extra time between classes or at home to try to do as much preparation as possible so that we'll be prepared to go into class. And even if we don't understand what the teachers are telling us, we've read the textbook, so we know what's, mm-hmm. you know, we have a little bit of comfort level,
yeah.
in trying to figure out what the teacher's saying, as opposed to teacher teaching us history. It's more like us trying to figure out what we read in the history book and where the teacher is in explaining that to us. So, you know, imagine like the book knowledge,
yeah.
and you look up the dictionaries and you're trying to get that in your head before going to class.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the only way, I mean, that's what school is,
yeah.
for us. So it was more, you know, trying to bring your English up to the level of your spoken English and listening up to the level of your understanding of the written English. By the time I graduated, I was taking most classes in regular class with, you know, 9th graders, 10th graders, not necessarily 12th graders, but. But at the same time, I still spend a lot of time in this one sort of classroom that was dedicated to ESL students, and there were volunteers helping them with the homework. So I think I picked up more Spanish slangs than, you know, English slangs at the time, and that was fun. And it was also an interesting experience seeing people from very different background and very different expectations about what a 17-year-old is supposed to be, and mm-hmm. how much responsibility you have, either because you're an immigrant and you are the one who has to take care of a lot of things for their, you know, for your parents, and some of the role reversal that happens, that because you are the one who understands English the most,
mm-hmm.
even if my English is limited, it's much better than my mother's. So, you know, anything that goes wrong, I have to call and try to figure out who the right people to call.
Yeah.
Is this an emergency or is this a normal thing? Or, you know, if you have parents-teacher conference, I have to interpret what the teacher is saying to my parents and then interpret backwards with my limited English. So a lot of the sort of relationship between parents being the guide and the protective influence versus children being sort of shielded from dealing with all the everyday things, it reverses at that point. You know, you sort of become the grown-up, you sort of become the public face of the family. So that was interesting too. So that was sort of a transitional period where my language skill was very, very limited, but at the same time I had to make the most of it and I couldn't really shy away from it because that was my responsibility for the entire family. Because I mean, my father was using English somewhat at work, but he wasn't there most of the time, he was at work. So I had to get the driver's license quickly so we can go grocery shopping instead of waiting for weekend. Or just to, you know, drive people around. So a lot of sort of thing, housekeeping things that I had to learn to try to do it quicker. And it was different from what I was used to. It's not that I didn't do that at all in Tokyo when I was growing up, but it was a lot easier for kids to do. I could get around on bicycles anywhere. And whereas, you know, here, especially in the suburbs, you have to.
So, where on the island did you move to?
Port Washington, okay. In the North Shore.
I lived out on the North Fork, but yeah. It was not quite suburban.
Yeah, well, the reason why my father picked Port Washington is because it's at the end of that Long Island Rail Road line that he used to commute. So he learned that when he was younger, that because of the commute in Tokyo is notorious for being packed and very uncomfortable. He always wanted to find a place at the end of the line so that, you know, he'll stand and like get a seat, like, you know, like half an hour earlier.
Yeah.
Let a couple of trains pass and he can get a seat and take that in all the way through. And he thought it was going to be the same here, so he picked the same. And also the fact that they had a very good ESL program. So looking back, it was a beautiful place, but not having a way to get around was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of the time taking the train coming into the city and, you know, going to the village. And, you know, Tawalekas in the village was so different from Tawalekas in, like, you know, malls in Long Island. So
yeah.
That's, you know, that's what I did. And then I went to school in the city. So I moved out of the house, lived in a dorm.
College?
Yeah. I went to Barnard for 4 years. So that was the first time living away from home and also living 24 hours in English. Which was very, very stressful. Mm. By the time I graduated high school, I was fairly confident at school because of the fact that you can actually prepare for school.
Right.
You know what to expect. And you can interact with the teachers within the classroom. Social life was different, but you know, you could get by feeling that you understand what's going on. Whereas living in a dorm, most of the interaction, most of the critical interaction is outside of the classroom. And really just learning how to explain things, like real day-to-day, you know, where it hurts, if you're tired, like the different kind of tiredness, or just, it's a lot more about explaining how you feel than a subject matter that you know or you don't know. Mm-hmm. And that was a very different experience. And at first it was very, very stressful, that I didn't have a break from that.
Mm-hmm.
The fortunate thing is that Columbia had an amazing Japanese language library, so I spent a lot of time in the library reading books that I like. But at the same time, that's sort of like a little bit of space I have because of the fact that I have spent. It takes a lot longer for me to digest textbooks than, you know, my classmates. So it was really nice to be living in a dorm so that you can spend a lot of hours studying, preparing for it, spend time in the library. But at the same time, just not having that sort of break and coming home and being comfortable in my own language was difficult for the first 6 months.
Yeah.
But then also you make new friendships, you gain different friends, and the first year, all my friends were children of immigrants. They were the first generation Americans, or they immigrated when they were very, very small. So it was fortunate that they understand the fact that your limitation on language doesn't necessarily mean that you're stupid, which is a big, big, big help in terms of communicating with them, because they never talk down to you.
Right.
They may repeat themselves, but they'll never like talk down to you and slow it down like you're talking to a child, because they understand that's not the case. I mean, some people did do that, thinking that's helpful, and it is in a way, but it's also at the same time very, very insulting. But I couldn't say that at the time, because I could tell that the person on the other side meant well. And it's much later in my life that I learned the expression, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And when I heard that, I'm like, I know exactly what that means. So I spent 4 years at Barnard, and spent also 6 months in London in my junior year. I really liked school, I really liked college, but at the same time, I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in the United States after I graduated. That was around the time when Japan was doing very, very, very well economically, and there were a lot of opportunities for students returning from overseas, being bilingual. I had a very hard time understanding Americans.
Americans?
And I realize now that it's not the Americans in general, but it's Northerners, people in the North, urban people who seems very nice, very friendly, but they don't really mean it.
So you mean you have trouble understanding them?
In terms of the social distance, not necessarily the language itself. And I always sort of attribute it to like, well, maybe I didn't understand what the person was saying, I misunderstood what the person was saying, but a little bit later on I learned that no, that's just the way they are. They say things that they don't really mean it. And I had a lot of that in college, in social situations, especially the area part. So even though my language skill was getting better and I began to understand a lot more about my surroundings, I wasn't quite comfortable. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to live in the United States. At the same time, I didn't know I wanted to go back to Japan yet. I knew it was much better than I expected at the time in terms of the opportunities that you have and also the professional chances. For women in general at that time, things changed so much with the economic boom that the first time in the history they had the equal employment opportunity legislation encouraging employers to hire, well, give equal opportunity to men and women. There was no enforcement, there was no measurement of achievement or compliance with that. But it was largely symbolic, but because of the economic reality of companies looking for well-educated workers, it was actually happening.
Right.
So I knew that that was a possibility, that I could actually find a professional opportunities and a real job and that I could stay. And being expected to stay, not just, you know, work for a couple of years and, you know, get married and move on. But at the same time, I felt like, well, I spent a few years here. I sort of know New York and the United States, but when I go back, I'll probably lose a lot of what I learned, probably lose my language skills, and I didn't feel like I gained something solid enough to take back and not lose all the things that I worked so hard for. So I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do after I graduated. So in my third year of school, I decided, well, maybe there's another way. Maybe it doesn't have to be Japan or the US. So did some research and found out that there is some kind of, it's not an official program, but at least reciprocal agreement that the Barnard will recognize the credit from the University of London.
Okay. Yeah.
So I decided to go to the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London for 6 months. And the reason why I did that for the spring term is that British system is similar to, well, Japan copied the British system, so they have the trimester. If you go in spring, you get to do the second trimester and the third. So I figured you get more out of spending a semester away by taking two instead of going in the fall, where it's just the first time. This time. And also at the time, my lady was into British music culture. Well, not food, but you know, fashion, everything.
So. Yeah.
Okay, I want to go to London. So I spent 6 months in London, thinking that the school life is similar there. So first, I lived on campus housing. There was no such thing. There was no campus at SOAS. There was only one building. It was more like the NYU back in the day. Mm-hmm. Well, even here now, like you have different schools. University of London had like different schools split over all around downtown. Some of the more mainstream colleges, like King's College, I think had a dorm even nearby. But SOAS didn't have anything. They had a whole bunch of flats in North London, about 45 minutes on the tube. So. That's when, at first I looked for a room share and you know, posted in a student office and went around a few places and I was like, this is not working. There are way too many creepy people. And it wasn't really a room share, it was just sort of like the corner, you know, in one side of the flat you had like the futon spread on the floor and then like, that's your room and that's like 500 quid a month. I'm like,
right.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
but you know, it's, you know, dollar was about $1.70 to a pound, so I wanted to keep it to the same level as like what my father was paying for the dorm here, which was expensive too, but you know, I didn't want to cost him any more than he was spending already. So North London is where I spent 6 months among a whole bunch of students from Middle East. That was my first time I actually got to talk to somebody from Lebanon, Kuwait, and a lot of Arabs living in, coming from Africa actually. Mm-hmm. Some of them actually lived in Africa. I think there are some Syrians, mostly Lebanese and Kuwaitis that I met. An American who wanted to go to Africa, but they were, the place he was going to go to just erupted into a civil war, so he couldn't go, so he decided to come to London because he already took the time off from school and he couldn't go back. And Antiguan American, I don't know why he was in the same school, but he was friends with the American kid. A South African born Indian living in, coming from a suburb of London. A whole bunch of her friends, so I met a lot of Asians there. Asians in London at the time and South Asian, not us. No, I'm East Asian. But we were more Orientals than the Asians.
What year is this?
In the 90s, early 90s.
Early 90s.
And that's what I learned when I went to SOAS. So I realized like why SOAS was next to the School of Tropical Disease. It's a school for colonial bureaucrats and administrators. So you go study the language at SOAS. So you learn in African, East Asian, all the colonial footprints that the British Empire had. At SOAS, you go to School of Tropical Disease to get immunized and then you're off.
Huh.
So, yeah, we were like next to the School of Tropical Disease.
Interesting.
It was fun, yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. But so, you definitely saw the legacy of colonialism there, that a lot of the students there were from former colonies and also Middle East where elite gets educated outside their home countries. Yeah, I met a Dutch guy. So, and then also the European Union, they didn't charge tuition.
Hmm.
If you're within European Union, that they had a reciprocal agreement that you didn't really pay tuition for universities. So, I mean, they loved foreign students because that's where they get to charge tuition. So there were a lot of language students from Asia, particularly from Japan, just coming to the language school. A lot of Americans on study abroad program. Well, not a lot at SOAS, but a few. And people from all over. So it was interesting living with South Asians and especially Middle Eastern friends, because that's the time of the first Gulf War. I was there when it started. So it was very, very interesting watching it on TV, on British television, among the Arabs,
right.
Talking about a very, very different perspective and take on what's happening and what it means. And that was my first experience of war as well. Mm-hmm. That was the first immediate. I mean, I grew up in post-war Japan, and mm-hmm. we're like, no army, no weapon. We don't engage in, we are not allowed to engage in that, and we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the World War II. So even though in Britain, you know, they had the Falklands, so they sort of have made a modern conflict. For me, it was a first experience of knowing that somebody that I know may actually go to war.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew so little that I actually called back to my friend's home and said, are you going to be drafted and do you have to go to war? Because that was the image that I had of that, like, once, you know, country engages in the war, you get drafted and you go to war. But no, it's a volunteer army. So I'm like, oh, that doesn't happen until they get really desperate. So, you know, like college-age kids, I thought, like, they'll be the prime candidate to get shipped off. But that didn't happen. So, It was really good to see that, especially, you know, looking at what's happening now and how it gets broadcasted here.
Mm-hmm.
The whole controversy with the friendly fire. I mean, that was the first Gulf War. Most of the British casualties were killed by the Americans. And also, it was very, very tense going to school because we had a very large concentration of Middle Eastern students.
Mm-hmm.
So. And we used to joke about it. We should just, like, we would joke and say, like, we should go to really expensive restaurants, you know, eat whatever we want, leave a big, you know, sort of duffel bag on the seat and just run away. And everybody would have my kid away. So, you know, we were all, like, struggling students and trying to save money. We're like, yeah, we should really go to that restaurant we always wanted to go. So, you know, we had, like, enough sense to joke about it, but... at the same time, it was a very tense time for
mm-hmm.
me on campus where all the newscasters descended to try to ask opinions of the Arabs on what's
mm-hmm.
going on. So, and I really actually did like living in London.
You did?
Even though I didn't like living in North London and having to take the 2-3 zones into the city, but culturally speaking, I had a much better, easier time understanding the social distance of the English
mm-hmm.
than the Americans. Even though I didn't understand a lot of the words that they were saying, a lot of the accent that they had, I understood what they meant
mm-hmm.
versus what they said. The distance between that is very, very similar to what I grew up with. So,
can you describe that difference?
For Japanese, what we say and what we mean are two separate things, and there's an understanding of that. Depending on the context, depending on the relationship, depending on the situation, we say certain things, but you need to leap between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
There's a conventional expression and understanding of the personal distance, that you may extend something to somebody, but depending on your relationship with that person, the other person would understand that if it's a real invitation,
okay.
Or if that person's being polite to you.
So it's very nuanced.
Yeah, and it's a lot more, the conversation had a lot more to do with the relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's never, and also sort of social hierarchy. The politeness of, I think the politeness of it, the degree of politeness that the British, or the, I should say English, displayed to each other in the context that I understood was a lot more similar.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship between teachers and students, it was a lot, the distance between the two, I felt a lot more comfortable
mm-hmm.
in the UK university system than in the United States. Where there's, you know, the professors pretend to be your peers, and you know,
yes,
like, right. I was uncomfortable with that. I mean, there's definitely power relationships, but they try not to acknowledge that
mm-hmm.
a lot of the times in the United States, especially with older people, younger people. Older people try too hard to be cool, I think, in the U.S. They try so, you know, really hard to be young or understanding of the youth, whereas in Britain, there's no pretense. Like, you know, if you are of a certain age, you're supposed to behave a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and that's okay. That's, you know, that's not a reflection of, you know, you not being cool.
Yeah.
So, I think that, yeah, I think it's the value, the definition and the value that you place to a certain characteristic and definition based on your social standings, age, all these other attributes. I had an easier time understanding that. Mm-hmm. It's not that I liked it or not. I mean, it's very structured, and sometimes it makes it difficult for real friendship to develop if your standing is so different.
Right.
But also at the same time, if it does happen, it makes it more meaningful, which has been my experience with some of my friends back home who are of my father's generation. It just was easier distance to understand, and there was less disappointment in terms of what the other person extend to you versus what you understood the closeness to be or the friendliness to be. So I really liked living there, and I wanted to stay there longer, but I wasn't sure of the job prospect. But graduate school, definitely, like, I was thinking that's a possibility. And because of the fact that SOAS especially emphasized a lot more of getting a language to the native level before you move on to graduate study. I mean, it was a must. You have to be able to read things in primary language and do research in primary source to do your undergraduate thesis.
Undergraduate?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was sitting in a class, undergraduate class, leading modern Japanese from 1890s, which is a very difficult Japanese for us natives. We had to learn it too, but I was sitting there discussing, well, leading untranslated work. So it was easier for me.
Right.
Than being in the United States, but and that was the expectation. So here in the U.S., I could take Japanese language classes, but everybody discussing the work that I'm familiar with, reading it in English and discussing it in English. Discussing in English was fine, but just the fact of having to read it in English and looking at weird translations was different. So I came back with the sort of sense of, okay, maybe that was the place, culturally speaking. Except for the fact that it was very hard for it was very hard for anybody to get a job in the UK at the time. So, but that's a really long, I can go on for the next 17, that was my first 20 years of my life, and I can go for the next 17 years, but you might want to skip ahead or?
Let's move on to your sexuality.
Okay.
You identify as?
Lesbian.
Lesbian. Tell me about when you came out, actually go back to when you knew.
I always knew when I was growing up. But in Japan, teenage homosexuality for girls is sort of almost expected. You know, you sort of practice and move on to the real thing. So everybody joked about it, everybody knew. Girls used to give me, flowers, well, not flowers, but, make me lunch, make me things. In Valentine's Day in Japan, it's a big commercial conspiracy, but the candy companies came up with this idea and came up with some legend somewhere in Europe that's the day the girls can actually get to confess to boys what they feel, how they feel about it. Unlike, girls are supposed to wait and not really be forthcoming, but that's one day of the year. You can be in charge of expressing your feelings, blah, blah, blah. And it was universally understood that I'm going to be on the receiving end on that day instead of giving side of it. I got a lot, but I always knew. But I always knew I was more attracted to girls. But it was different from sexuality, because of the idea of sexuality was very much a grown up thing. Mm-hmm. So the part about the sort of orientation part of your emotional attachment, your attraction, was fairly clear, but that didn't get connected to the actual sexuality part of it until much, much, much later.
By you or by your culture?
By me, I think. Some of the girls, I think, it's a lot different now. Things change so much, and a lot more young people know about sex and sexuality much younger. But when I was growing up, I don't think we really talked about it in junior high school. I mean, like, we talked about dating, like, you know, the having crush on boys and things like that. But it was more like, oh, I want to, you know, like, spend time with them, get close to them, hold hands with them to that extent. Mm-hmm. I think kissing came into play maybe in high school, but it was still like, whoa, big deal then. Because even though we are in co-ed school, the boys' world and girls' world were really segregated. It was sort of implicit. And also, like, crossing over got so much backlash from your group and got a reputation that's like, ooh, you really like boys,
okay,
kind of thing. So yeah, even in the co-ed school, that was the context. So a lot of the girls sort of had the practice one with the girls that they liked and had like very close relationship. And in girls' schools, a lot more explicit and rampant, and that was completely acceptable.
Was it talked about?
Yeah, everybody knew. I mean, like, parents, kids, you know. My straight friend who went to Catholic high school, she had long hair, very feminine, but she got letters, candies from underclass girls all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, you know, younger students really having a crush on the upper class, not men, but upper class men in girls' schools. Talked about, written about, practiced. And I think for a grown-up's point of view, it was sort of a safe thing, precisely because it didn't involve sexuality, or they assumed that it didn't.
Right.
It was sort of like emotional relationship without the threat mm-hmm. of sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I didn't go to girls' school, so I don't know to what extent there was actually sexuality involved, but a lot of the grown-ups think that it's sort of like a healthy development in terms of having curiosity about forming a relationship, but, you know, it's safe.
Yeah.
Right? So it was funny, like, when I was in junior high school trying to find, you know, think about which high school to go to, all my friends like, don't go to girls' school, don't go to girls' school. Then you, like, you get the taste of it, you'll never get out of it. So there was a universal understanding that if I, you know, were put in a situation that would be sort of it, that I'll feel very comfortable in that situation, I'll never come back to sort of graduate in that phase and behaving like a girl. So in that sense, I always knew, and I think people knew, and even sort of my parents and my relatives always talked about, I have a younger sister, 2.5 years apart. I was the oldest grandchild on either side, but everybody's expectation was my sister's gonna get married first and I'm gonna be a working woman. So, and also the fact that the way I dressed and the fact that I always wanted to do things that people associated with boys, or I could compete with them. I was very competitive, mm-hmm. so I could compete with them, and also in terms of the leadership in class, like becoming class president, or in the student government, like the roles that I play was always sort of like the leadership role.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody sort of didn't give me a hard time about that, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of unusual. And I think it had to do with the fact that that we were in a new community,
mm-hmm.
and we also got a very young, eager teachers. Because of the fact that it was very new development, and it was very it wasn't connected by public transportation yet. It was a planned community, so they developed the town first, and then they put the label line
mm-hmm.
after we got enough density to sustain the label line. So a lot of the times, young teachers stayed out of school who wanted to come to Tokyo and stay in Tokyo would take the exam for the prefecture. Their first assignment tend to be in remote places, like in islands, or mm-hmm. us.
Okay.
So we got a lot of great teachers coming in who are not necessarily super experienced, but they have a lot of great ideas,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't really caught up in conventions and traditions. So I never thought, it's usually like when you look at any kind of literature or Japanese comic books, in co-ed situations, it's usually the class leader is the boy and the vice chair, whatever the title is, will be the girl. wasn't the case when I was around. Everybody sort of understood that I'm the leader and then whoever is going to be the second, you elect like one female, one female to the position, and then it's almost expected that the boys would be number one and girl would be the second one. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
So I was used to that. And I think that was part of the reason why girls sort of look at me as sort of pseudo boy kind of role. And it's the same thing from a girl's perspective too. It's a safe alternative to actually being, engaged in trying to build a relationship with boys.
Right.
Because you don't get teased that as, not a slut, but like as a boy crazy, or you don't get the kind of scrutiny you get from your parents if you're hanging out with boys. So anyway, I think, so in terms of, I knew early, and people knew early, but I think the expectation was I'll grow up at some point. In terms of, since this is about style and fashion, I assume, in terms of how I dress, when I was younger, I did like wearing like pants and jeans and t-shirt. I dressed up in the formal occasions. My father was in the apparel industry. So, we would always get the best suit for the graduation. But in terms of everyday wear, I think I was fairly aware early on that the girls got the short end of the stick. Like, there was like a very strict expectation about what girls aren't allowed to do. And I wasn't happy with that. So I thought the way to be taken seriously, the way to be equal, was to behave like boys. I don't think necessarily I wanted to be boys, I was just pissed off that I couldn't, be on the same level as them in the eyes of the grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
Or like anybody, my peers or my upperclassmen. So I think I was fairly consciously trying to destroy the expectation every chance I got. And I also learned that that's possible. Like, once you prove to them that you can do it, they'll call you names, but still, they'll call you names, but you can earn a certain level of respect that way. And, wearing girls' clothes and what's sort of not conducive to the activities that that I like doing, and, running around, beating up on boys, showing that, who's the boss.
Right.
But when you get to junior high school, at least in my district, you have to wear school uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And I agonized over, asking my parents for boys' uniform. But I didn't even want to get picked on, right away by the upperclassmen. So I'm like, okay, I don't want to stand up. Sorry. So I went reluctantly with the girls' uniform. And, people made fun of me for wearing a skirt and, not used to seeing a skirt. But you get used to it if it's uniform.
Yeah.
But that sort of made me a little bit self-conscious. It's not that I didn't like dressing in skirt. I mean, any formal occasion when my father brings home the brand new three-piece suit with a nice pleated skirt, I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that I didn't like dressing, but I think I was sort of aware of the fact that if you dress like a girl, people make fun of you, because they're not used to seeing it. Once they sort of have an image of you as a particular type of person, then, and a lot of the boys tease me that, you behave like a boy. So it's sort of, that was sort of stuck with me.
Right.
So whether I liked it or not, it's one of those things that people tease you about if you change or deviate from what they expect of you. So, junior high school, even though I wore uniform to school on weekends, it was pretty much back to jeans and t-shirt. Then when I came here, and I also always had hair kind of short, I never grew my hair long. When I first came here, one of the things that was really liberating was that nobody had any expectation of me other than the fact that I'm Japanese and I don't speak English all that well. later on, I realized that, like, you know, the whole Japanese female thing and what you have to deal with, but at that time, the language thing was a lot bigger.
What do you mean, the Japanese female thing?
You don't understand how many people stop you on the street, like, I lived in Japan, it's great. Mostly former servicemen.
Like men hitting on you?
Not necessarily hitting on you, they're friendly, but, you know, you have certain expectations about Japanese women being submissive, docile, polite, you know, really takes care of their men kind of thing.
Okay.
Which is... And also, there's a whole image of Asian women in American popular culture, mm-hmm. dated back, way back. There was a great documentary on PBS on that. The split image of, you know, Asian women being Dragon Lady versus the, Madame Butterfly, I guess. Yeah. Those are two iconic images, and sometimes men have a fantasy of having both in the same person. So, you know, you may look very innocent and pure and quiet on the surface, but you'll be, you know, once you get to that point, you're a freak and you have all kinds of, you know, amazing sexual abilities. And I learned that lesbians have the same stereotype to me.
Really?
Yeah, they think we have some kind of special techniques or shaolin, but yeah, that's much later. So at that time, it was sort of completely free to reinvent myself in a way. I mean, it was hard not being able to articulate what you were thinking about, what you were observing, what you wanted to express. But at the same time, that sort of took the edge off of how people saw me. Like, you know, I was always very vocal. I was always the, there's this thing in Japanese schools that when you graduate or when you move on to a different grade, you actually come up with like a little booklet to sort of commemorate your classmates or your experience that year. And then, you know, we were voting, like, you know, who's, you know, the most successful, with all the things that you do on it's a similar
right.
thing.
Superlatives.
Yeah, so like, what's the fastest learning class? So, we didn't need the most popular, like, you know, but we had like all kinds of things. Like, I'd always be the toughest. Boys and girls, by none, toughest, number one. And also the one who speaks so fast. I'll be the fastest speaker. So, you know, the way sort of my mind worked and the way I articulated myself tend to give people a very strong impression of me being sort of not unfeminine, but at the same time, it's a very sort of outspoken personality mm-hmm. that people don't necessarily associate with virtue or femininity. And it wasn't ideal characteristic for women. So the fact that I couldn't speak all that well and I didn't speak much, and the fact that I'm in a completely foreign environment where people dress different, you know, people did their hair different, high school kids wore makeup, which could be a cause for dismissal back in the days in Japan. Not anymore, but, you know, when I was growing up, just coloring your hair, perming your hair, that was a cause for, like, suspension. It actually, nobody said anything if I wore a dress. Mm-hmm. No, they said, oh, that's a nice dress, or, you know, where did you get it? But they didn't make fun of me for that. So I was like, wait a minute, so I can try different things and not necessarily have to deal with people's, you know, image of me. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that when I came here, I couldn't find a hairdresser that I could trust, or I couldn't explain to them what I needed done.
Yeah.
My mother's best friend is a hairdresser, so I never had anybody else cut my hair. So I come here, white folks in Long Island don't know what to do with my Asian hair. I wanted it short, but it always comes up awful. So I decided, like, okay, I'm going to cut my hair. I'm not going to go through the trauma of sitting in a, you know, beauty parlor, like, playing that they don't mess it up. So I started growing my hair in high school, and I kept it long. So I looked, you know, very, very different. Mm-hmm. And nobody really made fun of me for growing my hair out or getting a perm or, that was interesting in terms of my own idea of gender image. I always thought like I was a boyish girl and I was comfortable with it. But then I started to question it and say, like, was I doing it because like, to behave like a girl mm-hmm. was disadvantageous to what I wanted to do. Is it something that people taught me to do versus like what I really felt comfortable doing? So I sort of went and lived in that body for a while, which was kind of nice and which was kind of fun. And I realized like I'm much more feminine than I thought I was. And I'm much more comfortable being feminine. I'm less embarrassed about dressing like a girl. And it's actually kind of fun. I never really went so far as to put on the makeup. My mother traumatized me. When the first time I put on the lipstick, my mom was like, you look like a drag queen.
Oh no.
Thank you, mother. So, I mean, you know, I picked up a black lipstick, like red one that my mother had. Yeah. That was my mistake. But so she kept me in check about like, you know, what's suitable for me versus like, so, you know, I never really, after that I'm like, okay, I'm not putting on any lipsticks. But, so most of my college years, I looked quite girly. Mm-hmm. I'm not girly girl, but, you know, long hair, well, both, you know, jeans and skirt. But I didn't make much of wearing a dress or really girls clothing. I shouldn't say girls clothing, but. And then, at the time, I thought I could be bisexual as well. Well, no, I think I wasn't even thinking about sexuality in terms of my attraction to girls. I mean, you know, I definitely pay more attention to women and how pretty they are or how good looking they are or like who appealed to me. But at the same time, it's almost like it was the other way around. That was a practice for me that I thought mm-hmm. like I could actually date boys. Right. So, and I did have a chance a few times.